From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, the lower chamber of the Russian parliament, the Duma, called for extra security for the country's diplomats after the assassination of Andrei Karlov, Russia's ambassador to Turkey. The gunman, a Turkish police officer, shouted protests against Russia's bombing in Syria after he shot Karlov and wounded three others in an art gallery in Ankara. David Pilipov is Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post. He's joining us from there by Skype. And David, what are people there saying about this terrible shooting broadcast live?
Well, first of all, people here, like everywhere else, were shocked. It was graphic and it was brutal. I mean, you didn't have to be a Russian to get that. But in Russia as well, where the effort to make a connection with Turkey, the effort to expand Russia's presence in the Middle East, and also the effort to have a rapprochement with Turkey after the incident in the end of 2015 when a Russian jet was shot down by Turk. All of that comes into play. But most importantly, in the way that Russia is right now, where so much of what's happening in the outside world is seen as a conspiracy to keep Russia down, the most prominent thing you hear as an explanation is that somebody else is behind this. This is foreign security agencies. This is the West. This is somebody trying to get us by shooting our ambassador.
Well, let's pick that up because the gunman shouted, "Remember Aleppo." Now, just to flesh this out, Russia is backing President Assad in the civil war. Turkey was arming some of the fighting against him. You're noticing something interesting about what people aren't saying about the shooter.
Right. Well, Russian leadership is talking about this being aimed at Russian-Turkish relationships, this being an act of terrorism. No, it wasn't. It was a gunman who assassinated the Russian diplomat as he's crying, you know, "Remember Aleppo." If anything, this is directly retribution for the Russian military role in backing the Syrian regime in Aleppo and in Syria. Russia carried out airstrikes. Russia carried out missile attacks. Russian special forces are on the ground. This is an assassination.
But why isn't Turkey saying that?
Turkey has no interest in drawing attention to Russia's role in Aleppo. Yeah. Turkey and Russia right now are trying to point out what's common to them, which is that they both want to bring the conflict to an end. Also, for Turkey, this is extremely embarrassing. The lack of security, the ability for a gunman to get in there, that looks bad for Turkey.
Well, what do people in Russia that you talk to think about Russia's involvement in Syria? Has this assassination made some people sit up and say, well, wait a second, you know, our country was bombing Aleppo? Or is support, you know, pretty steadfast?
I think that at the moment, people don't connect the two, mainly because the assassination has been portrayed largely as a blow against Russia, a blow against Russian influence, a blow against Russia's efforts to make geopolitical partners, and likely something that somebody like the West is doing to us. So the idea that this is something, that we're doing something wrong in Aleppo, hasn't really come up. Furthermore, Russia has gone out of its way to point out all the things it's doing right in Aleppo, bringing humanitarian aid, trying to let civilians out of the city. So if you're a casual Russian observer or even an informed Russian observer, what you're seeing is Russia is trying to help people, trying to fight terrorists, and trying to make partnerships with the end of ending the violence. And this assassination is going against that, not Russia is causing atrocity and this assassination is revenge for that.
There's so much else going on. You've got Turkey, Iran, and Russia meeting without the U.S. to talk about the future of Syria. But you've also got the U.S. intelligence reports concluding that Russia hacked the U.S. election with the goal of tilting it towards Donald Trump. What do people there say about that?
Well, first of all, you can't find anybody in Russian officialdom who doesn't call that absolute nonsense. I think that the note went out, call it absolute nonsense. Quietly, people are actually very afraid, on the one hand, what that means. If the United States thinks that Russia is stealing elections, what's it going to do to us? And then on the other hand, there's the overall, you know, cynical idea that Russia needs to use cyber crime and cyber hacking in order to get into the heads of Western countries because it can't compete with them by traditional means. So there is a little bit of, yeah, we're good enough to do that. And there's a lot of, no, there's no way. Show us the evidence. We won't believe you. We don't believe you. It didn't happen.
Well, is there also a little bit of we can't wait for this new guy? Because we know the U.S. has imposed new sanctions against Moscow because of the annexation of Crimea, the continued intervention in eastern Ukraine, where there's been more fighting between pro-Russian rebels and Ukrainian forces this week. Are there Russians saying we can't wait for Donald Trump to get in because he does appear to be more pro-Russia and perhaps those sanctions will be removed?
Well, you know, Russians are really smart and they pay attention to what's going on in the world. However, if you turn on the TV news, it's basically saying Donald Trump is coming and he's going to be more positive. On the surface level, you know, Trump has named a few people, the Secretary of State nominee, the National Security Advisor, who have a record of being pro-Putin or having involvement in Russia. But what does that mean when he gets to the full power of the United States of America and a Russian plane does a buzz by on an American carrier? What's he going to do then? Is he going to be really pro-Russian at that moment? I don't know.
David Filipov, Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post in Moscow. David, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
More than 24 people have been reported killed in protests in the Democratic Republic of Congo as demonstrators demand President Joseph Kabila step down. Kabila's second and final term ended Monday, but he's digging in his heels and refusing to leave. Congo was colonized by Belgium until 1960, but the nation has never experienced a peaceful post-independence transition of power. Reuters correspondent Aaron Ross is in the Congolese capital of Kinshasa, and he joins us via Skype. Aaron, first of all, tell us, what is Kabila's reasoning that he should stay in power?
Well, the justification the government gives is that they are simply not able to organize elections this year. The presidential election was supposed to take place in November. The government says because of the need to register millions of voters and because of budget shortfalls, they're unable to do it this year. And they've negotiated an agreement with a small part of the opposition to actually hold the election in April 2018 at the earliest. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's not satisfying to a large part of the opposition.
Well, give us some background here, because Kabila has been in power for nearly 16 years. His father was assassinated in 2001, and then Kabila himself took over power. What has his tenure as president of Congo been like?
Yeah, there's been a real evolution. When Joseph Kabila came to power in 2001, he was a 29-year-old, the youngest or possibly the second youngest world leader. He served in the army, but he was known to be shy. He did not speak much French, the official language here in Congo. He won democratic elections in 2006. He won elections again in 2011, although those were considered by most observers to be marred by widespread fraud. But certainly he's grown more confident in his role as president. And you see that certainly in the assertive stance that his government has taken regarding his remaining in power.
And yet he's also been accused of looting millions of dollars in public assets, has he not?
Yeah, there have been some recent accusations. There was a Bloomberg piece that documented extensively the holdings of his family throughout the country that extended everywhere from the mining sector to much smaller businesses. And that has gone contrary to an image that his supporters have liked to put forward about Kabila, which is that he's not one of these African leaders who we know to have, you know, mansions in France, extensive offshore holdings that have been investigated by European or the American governments. However, more and more through some investigative reporting, we're getting a sense of just how much of a hold the Kabila family really does have over the Congolese economy.
Mm. So then tell us, who does the opposition then want to see in power instead of Joseph Kabila?
Well, the opposition has always been a very divided bunch in Congo. And so getting a consensus on who they would like to replace Kabila is a tall order. There are some names that are always floating around. There's the longtime opposition leader, Etienne Tshisekedi. However, he's 84 and relatively failing health. There's another opposition figure, Moise Katumbi, the former governor of the Katanga province, but who's currently in exile as he was accused both of hiring mercenaries and of real estate fraud and left the country for medical reasons, but has not returned since. And that's been about 6 months now. So it's not clear exactly who would be the natural candidate to replace Kabila. And I would say that for many Congolese, there's a disillusionment with the political class more generally. So the frustration that we're seeing is largely a frustration over socioeconomic ills, but it's not necessarily a vote of confidence in the opposition.
Huh, interesting. Well, you know, at the beginning of the conversation, we mentioned that several dozen people have been killed in protests in Congo. Given that and what you just said, what do you see happening next in the coming days and weeks?
It's very difficult to say. Today we went out and it's much calmer. The protests and the violence have almost entirely died down in Kinshasa. We have some reports of some protests this morning in the mining hub of Lubumbashi. But overall, things really seem to have calmed down. The violence took place yesterday, and those are the deaths that we are still documenting. There are talks that are supposed to take place that the Catholic Church is moderating between the opposition and the government to discuss Kabila's future, to discuss when elections will take place. At the same time, they really haven't reached any common ground. So it's not clear if those talks will actually produce a compromise, or they could break down within a week, 2 weeks. And when we spoke to people on the streets, they said, well, we're willing to wait to see what that produces. But if it doesn't produce anything, then we might take it again to the streets.
Aaron Ross is a Reuters correspondent speaking to us today from Kinshasa. Aaron, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
The U.S. was on the sidelines yesterday when Russia, Iran, and Turkey met in Moscow to work out a deal to end the Syrian civil war. Russia and Iran backed the Assad regime. Turkey backed the Syrian rebels, but seems to have made a deal with Russia to give that up if Russia stops backing the Syrian Kurds. Turkey has long been worried about a Kurdish separatist movement. Sound complicated? Well, all of Syrian history is. Syria is a remnant of the Ottoman Empire, which fell at the end of World War I. Over decades, the French and the British split up the region according to their own needs. The French partitioned neighboring Lebanon and favored minority Christians. That created a dangerous imbalance of power. They took modern-day Syria and divided it into separate administrative units, divisions that still simmer today, and built the path to today's civil war. Tensions with the West and a void filled by Vladimir Putin and Russia. John McHugo wrote the book, Syria, A History of the Last 100 Years. He joins us from London. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We will go back in time, this incredibly storied history. It includes occupations by France and Britain. But just briefly, how did modern-day Syria and Russia align?
Well, I'm afraid this was because of a major mistake that the West made. In the 1950s, it was the era of the Cold War. It was also, of course, when the Arab-Israeli conflict was at its height. And basically, the Western powers abandoned Syria. Syria needed arms for its defense. The Western powers refused to sell them. You know the name Hafez al-Assad, who became the dictator of Syria in 1970.
Right.
Well, he began as an Air Force cadet. And as an Air Force cadet, he visited London for the only time in his life to learn to be trained to fly fighter aircraft. But that all ended. And instead, he spent a year in Russia. And there has been a huge connection between the Syrian military, the Syrian political elite, and trade connections, and also to some extent religious connections. Because let's remember that the largest Christian sect in Syria are the Orthodox, and they have co-religionists in Russia. And the Russians have always seen themselves as the protectors of the Orthodox.
Yeah.
And so when you have all these links, which have been allowed to grow in strength over the decades since the late 1950s, it's no surprise that Russia is closely connected to Syria. The Syrians have felt terribly abandoned by the West because they would really have far preferred to be with the West than with Russia.
Well, you remind us of so many things. First of all, Bashar al-Assad, who is Assad's son, his descendant, who's now ruling the country. The fact that many people think Syria is a Muslim country. It is largely Muslim, but there have always been these pockets of other countries within Syria as the nation state formed. And so let's take us back to how it formed. 400 years of Ottoman rule. In 1918, Arab troops supported by the British captured Damascus. Then post-World War I, the Ottoman Empire, which supported Germany, falls. The Allies divvy up the whole region, and the French take control of what's Syria, Lebanon, for more than two very fraught decades. How did that lead to some of even the problems that we're seeing today in Syria?
I think the first thing we have to realize that the boundaries Syria has were largely fixed by the British and the French. And those boundaries were devised to suit Britain and France. The local people, the Syrian people, I mean, it's a very interesting thing, but an Egyptian friend of mine said to me not so long ago, when I see someone on the television and he's speaking the dialect from that part, I cannot tell if he's a Syrian, a Lebanese or a Palestinian very often. And all these people, to some extent, were part of a cultural whole, something that could become a nation. But the British and the French did not want that to happen. And so, sadly, we partitioned Syria. Now, the partition essentially happened in 1922-23. And since then, Syria, as we know it today, by default, has become a nation state. And now the disaster in Syria today has many fathers. But we should not ignore the role that Britain and France, I'm afraid, played in it.
Well, the French tried to make French the common language. They favored Catholics over Islam. And as we said, this had been a country that was a cobbled together group of communities. William Polk, writing in The Atlantic, described it as little Italies and little Chinatowns that were all throughout the country. But then I want to move you ahead. The Ba'ath Party starts to rise to power. Ba'athists promoted the ideas, as they did in Iraq, that Syria should be a secular Arab state. Talk about how important this idea is to what we're seeing today.
First of all, with respect to William Polk, I don't think it was quite like that. They weren't cobbled together. They were already there together. And secularism goes back well before the Ba'ath Party. Faisal, who tried to set up a united Syrian state in 1919, said some words in Aleppo on the day that the First World War ended that I think we should really remember, and they aren't well known. He said the following: the Arabs were Arabs before Moses, before Jesus, and before Muhammad. And whoever tries to sow discord between Muslim, Christian, and Jew is not an Arab. I am an Arab before all else. And what the Syrian Arab nationalists were trying to do, well before the Ba'ath Party, was establish a secular state. One of the drafters of the Syrian constitution, Faris el-Khoury, was a Christian. Jews had their own seats in parliament. It is a huge tragedy that religious conflict has gone down, you know, has occurred, because I think it could have been avoided.
And How?
Because the idea was that Arabic would be the common tongue. They were proud of their Arab heritage. And I'm afraid a lot of people didn't want that to happen. If you're a businessman and the merchant elite was disproportionately Sunni Muslim in some places, like the city of Hama, if you find your property is being nationalized, or you find that you can have your own little shop in the souk, but all the big commercial opportunities have been taken away from you because cronies of the Ba'ath Party are taking them, you get angry. And religion, unfortunately, was the only avenue available to them. Now, the Ba'ath Party was thoroughly secular. And this brings us, of course, to Hafez al-Assad. He became the dictator after being head of the Air Force and then Minister of Defence. And he took power in a military coup. Now, he was an Alawi. But if anyone thinks this was some sectarian thing, they should think again. Because the man he overthrew was also an Alawi, Salah Jadid. And what happened was that Alawis and other minorities flocked to the Ba'ath Party because of its secular orientation. They wanted universal education. They wanted equal rights for women, something we should remember today, I think. They wanted an end to all involvement of religion in politics. Unfortunately, the Ba'ath Party was also a revolutionary organization, and it compromised these principles, basically by taking part in military coups. That, after all, is how Hafez al-Assad got to power.
Well, so Saddam Hussein in Iraq was also Ba'athist. He also had those same beliefs. Yes, a dictator, but he was for women's rights, more moderation, a secular society. What fundamentally went wrong here? As you say, there was this sort of living together. There was this mandate from Faisal: we're going to be Arabs first before our faith. What happened?
The problem that Saddam Hussein had in Iraq and that Hafez al-Assad had in Syria was basically the same. You come to power by a military coup. you have another, you have a narrow power base. How do you win support? The obvious means of doing so is patronage. That means that you give jobs to your cronies, first of all to your family. In the case of Syria, this meant that the president, Hafez al-Assad, and his wife, they tended to recruit people to look after the security services from their own families. They, of course, were all of the same religious sect, the Alawis. And the Alawis became disproportionately strong in the security services and the top brass of the army. In Iraq, it happened the other way around. There, the Sunni Arabs were a minority, but Saddam Hussein and his predecessors came from that minority. So where do you think he chose the Republican Guard from? From the tribes near his hometown, who were all Sunnis. So you had a kind of religious minority taking a disproportionate share of the of control of the country. And in both countries at the same time, they had put democracy into the deep freeze. And that meant that there was no way you could oppose the government. And sadly, this is what led open the door to serious hate-filled religious politics.
And the Arab Spring that we saw, the overthrowing of governments.
Yes, and of course, at the time of the Arab Spring, they hoped for an end to all the sectarianism as well.
John McHugo, author of Syria, A History of the Last 100 Years, also his other book, A Concise History of the Arabs. John, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
Nike began rolling out its first self-lacing shoe this month. Price tag? More than $700. Yesterday, Nike's earning report showed a 6% bump in overall sales compared to a year earlier. Not shabby, but the company's stock has fallen by more than 15% overall in 2016, and it's considered one of the worst performing stocks on the Dow right now. So what's really going on? Well, Maggie Lake, she hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake, and she joins us now from New York. Hi there, Maggie.
Hi, Meghna.
So what is happening with Nike? What did we learn from this earning report?
Worst performing stock this year. That's really a badge of shame, isn't it, considering the rally we've had. What we learned from the earnings report is, listen, Nike is still a force to be reckoned with. It was a good report. You mentioned that 6% increase in revenue. They showed renewed strength in China. They're growing sales at their own stores, which is probably important for the future. So athletic wear definitely remains a bright spot in what's an overall challenging retail space. The problem for Nike is that it's a hot space, but it's a super competitive one. And that seems to be where the concern lies. Some investors were looking at future orders and a little disappointed. And that's why you see the stock really lagging.
Okay. But let's take a look at those self-lacing shoes. A hot new product, apparently based on Back to the Future Part 2. Are new products like that going to draw more people to Nike?
I think so. I definitely think that's what they're hoping. And I think the thing with this shoe is it's a great talker, right? We all remember the movie. We're sort of obsessed with it. This is all about showcasing Nike's technology. The company's really betting that innovation is going to be what sets it apart from the competition. So they've got this, you know, great gimmick with the self-tying shoes. They're not going to be – it's not mass market. But if you look at what they've been doing, they filed over 600 patents this year alone, 60 of them just this past month. And they run the spectrum from activity monitoring to music streaming and all other sorts of digital things. So I think that's where they're really trying to set themselves apart from the Adidas, which is showing a rebound. And let's not forget about Under Armour. They are a newer, younger company. I've talked to Kevin Plank many times. They are super aggressive. So Nike wants to really show themselves as the innovator that other people try to copy.
Well, I think Under Armour is emblematic of where the athletic leisure industry has a name. Athleisure, am I saying that right?
yes.
is right now. It's massive. It's $44 billion in the United States. That's a number according to the research firm NPD Group. I mean, look, it was what, a decade or two ago where Nike was one of the dominant names in this kind of athletic wear. Do they have a problem now? Are they considered dated, or that just for athletes and not for the rest of us who are still wearing this stuff?
No, I don't think so. I think Nike still has a lot of cachet. And listen, let's look at basketball as an indication for that. People were worried about that space. They've come back strong there as well. And their shoes are doing well. So it's still really big. They do focus a lot on sports and teams. They're trying to do marathons under 2 hours. They continue to invest heavily in that kind of stuff. But athleisure wear is really big for them. But again, it's big for everybody. And not only do you have Under Armour and Adidas chasing that, but you have things like Lululemon. Regular retailers like The Gap and J. Crew are expanding their sort of fitness sections. If you've been in any stores, you go to Marshall's, it's full of athleisure wear. So everybody's sort of understanding that's where the strength is and piling into what was the space that was traditionally owned by Nike, maybe Reebok, you could argue. So it's getting really competitive. And by the way, not just women and men running around, kids, the kid market, they don't even market that. Wow. But I know Under Armour especially really strong there. So that's what all of them are having to cope with.
Maggie Lake with CNN Money. With Maggie Lake, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
On this day in 1998, then 12-year-old Brittany Martin's life changed when her younger brother's life ended and her father's was forever altered.
I was driving home from work, and I picked up my son first, went to the grocery store, and we were driving back. I was in a bit of a hurry, and that's the winter solstice, so it got dark early. And I pulled up to a stop sign, and I didn't see a car coming. I pulled out, another car T-boned into the side of me.
The crash was terrible. Paul's son, Brittany's brother Ryan, was ejected from the car and killed. Paul's neck broken. He became a quadriplegic, losing the use of both legs and much of his arms. Paul had to learn how to live. Brittany, watching, grew up devoting her life to helping others do the same thing with her nonprofit, Able Thrive. There are always challenges. You may have seen their wonderful YouTube video, him in a wheelchair dancing with Brittany at her wedding. A new DirecTV AT&T documentary, Resolution, Innovative Thinking About Disability, features Paul and Brittany. And now Brittany Martin Dejean joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Hi.
Hi. Thanks, Robin.
18 years ago, that can seem like a long time or a nanosecond, and it cannot be easy for you to hear your dad talking about that day.
Yeah, I mean, it's forever going to be something that, a moment that was one of the most difficult things that my family went through. But I think part of how we all get through it is learning how it moves you forward in the future. I mean, it's something that I've really come to understand even more in the last year, just reflecting more about the whole picture and how it impacted me. Because I was 12 and, you know, I found out about my brother before I found out about my dad. So once that happened, I really only wanted my dad to survive, especially as a kid. It's very simple.
Yeah.
It's life or no life. And that's something I've come to recognize, that from a kid's standpoint, you know, I was just happy to take my dad in the form that I was going to get him
right.
in.
You knew at that young age very quickly about death. You know, your brother was gone.
Exactly.
Your father was here.
Nah. exactly.
Yeah. And then you spend your teenage years watching him relearn how to live. He loved to walk in the woods, so he had a path built in the woods. He could get out there. You said you go on rolling strolls together. And here he is in the documentary talking about making, you know, gardening tools.
I've adapted a lot of tools to work with the hands. This is my grabbing hand. This is my kind of pointing hand and pushing hand.
What's happening as you're watching him? Are you aware of how much this is imprinting on you? You know, that this is something you're going to do?
No, not as a teenager. I mean, I'm aware because, you know, it's a part of my life. But again, a lot of it's mindset, you know, and I took a lot from my dad in terms of how he, you know, had this mindset of adaptation. We had this access to a great rehabilitation hospital in Philadelphia, which is called McGee Rehab Hospital, and they had mentor programs. So within the first 6 months of the accident, we were meeting people who were in the same physical situation as dad, just sometimes years ahead. Mm-hmm. So they were showing us what was possible. But again, it wasn't until I was in college that I studied abroad. I just went to explore the lives of people with disability and met someone who moved more than my dad, like just looking at his physical mobility after a spinal cord injury, and he could move more, but he told me that he'd spend the rest of his life in bed. And that's what changed everything. the whole month, really, that I investigated, met a lot of different people with disabilities. And that man in particular showed me that, you know, made me realize how lucky we had been to have the resources we had. Because when he so easily told me he'd spend the rest of his life in bed, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, well, why didn't we think that my dad would spend the rest of his life in bed? Hmm. So, you know, that reality shock was 10 years ago, really, really hit me. One, with a great sense of gratitude for what we did have, but a feeling that, hey, this doesn't have to be the way it is, because I couldn't help but feel for families that would have been like mine who wouldn't know that lives like ours were possible.
Well, you graduated from Harvard in 2008. You later co-founded Spinalpedia.com, a resource for the paralysis community. And then in 2013 started Able Thrive. This is a clearinghouse of information for the global disabilities community, that family in China. Just give me a few of the things that people might find through Able Thrive.
Really, the idea with Able Thrive is to open the doors of collaboration. Basically, we build relationships with organizations, companies, hospitals, bloggers who are already sharing. It's a very natural occurrence. You know, organically, the people are sharing all this stuff online to try to help others in similar situations. A woman, a paraplegic woman, was sharing about her pregnancy. And she was in Tasmania because she didn't know anyone else that was a paraplegic who was going through this. So she thought, okay, I'm going to share my experience going through maternity clothing, you know, how to deal with transferring from your wheelchair to the bed when you have a baby growing. We now share her blogs on Able Thrive and then connected her to plenty of other women who are with the similar mobility who have also gone through pregnancy and childbirth.
Huh. Well, then, Brittany Martin, there is dancing. And I should disclose that we met through my sister, Gail. You babysat her children there in Pennsylvania. And my sister worked, actually, with the paraplegic community. And so I'm one of the people who has been blubbering over your wedding YouTube video for a while now. But let's go back to how it all started, because you keep discovering mountains to climb. And one became your upcoming wedding. Let's listen to your dad talking again in the DirecTV documentary about possibly not being able to do something he loved. Let's listen.
I don't care who you are or how tough you are or what you've been through. The first time you look at your feet and you can't move them, you're going to freak out. And one of the things I do remember thinking about, which I spoke to my daughter, I was like, I'll never dance at her wedding, because I used to dance quite a bit.
But Brittany, then, you guys found a choreographer. Did you even know that was possible?
I did know people danced with wheelchairs. That's what's interesting about this story, is that for my dad, it wasn't about the physical issue of dancing. It was this emotional stumbling block, too, because he had danced so much before the accident. And it was just something that a door he had shut. I respected it being shut until selfishly for my wedding. I thought if he could be there with me that moment, it would be something I would really cherish forever, even if it was just a one-time thing. You know, and then he could shut it again. That was my kind of proposal.
So you find a choreographer, you work out a dance. Not only does he dance, but he does roll you down the aisle. I guess he rolls himself down the aisle. And then the dance. Let's just listen to a little. We urge people, go to hereandnow.org. You want to see this, but let's just listen to a little. Brittany, you guys have been through so much. What did this mean to you?
Oof. I mean, it's hard to have it only mean one thing. I mean, in a lot of ways, it was just my dad and I. You know, to be able to take part in that tradition where disability wasn't going to stop that from happening was so powerful. And that personally, that my knowing how difficult it was for my dad and how uncomfortable he was, the fact that he was willing to do that for me, obviously that means a ton. Mm. And then kind of more broad spectrum, it's just, you know, when you push the limits of what you think is possible, then, you know, you start to discover that more is possible than you might imagine, and that's not even necessarily specific to disability.
Well, and in fact, it opened other doors for him. He had also said he didn't think he could ever travel again. And I'm imagining that this is now something that Able Thrive can post when there's questions about how do we dance at our wedding.
So that's kind of how it started. So when I had started to request information from people through Able Thrive's network, hey, tips for dancing with a quadriplegic, a lot of people wrote back and said, let me know what you find when you find it, because my daughter's six. Or, you know, I started to see these people come through the woodworks that it was weddings are actually, you know, it surprised me how stressful they could be for people. Mm. At first, we shared it for all those people who had contacted me in the process. And because I thought we could get on the Ellen DeGeneres show. That's it.
You're honest.
So then when I started to see kind of it had a bigger impact, you know, than I realized because it got shared beyond the disability circles. And then it was just a story of a man overcoming, you know, kind of an emotional barrier for his child, which is a narrative that is very relatable to people. You don't have to personally understand disability to relate with my dad's story. People don't necessarily realize that there's plenty of parents out there with disabilities who have great lives and are wonderful parents. And so really it was a springboard challenging how people view disability in society. And it all just came because at my very core, I really just wanted my dad to dance with me at my wedding.
Brittany, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
On January 3rd, a jury will begin hearing evidence in the sentencing portion of the trial of Dylan Roof. Last week, Roof was found guilty of 33 charges of federal hate crimes in the killing of 9 people at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina in 2015. So the jury will now determine whether Roof will be sentenced to death. Of course, capital punishment remains a subject of intense debate in this country, but a report issued today by the Death Penalty Information Center shows actually its use is on a historic decline. Robert Dunham is the group's executive director. He joins us from Washington. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, Robert, when you say decline, what exactly do you mean?
The use of the death penalty is declining by almost all measures. I think the most significant one is that this year we will have fewer new death sentences imposed than in any time in the modern history of the United States death penalty, dating back to 1972 when the U.S. Supreme Court declared existing death penalty statutes unconstitutional. We're projected to have 30 death sentences this year. That's 40% below last year's number, which in itself had been a 40-year low. In addition to death sentences being at record lows, we had only 20 executions this year, which was the fewest in a quarter century. And only 5 states carried out executions, which was the lowest number of states to do so since 1983. What we're seeing is the death penalty is being used less and less by fewer states, by fewer counties within the states. And when prosecutors do seek the death penalty, it's being returned less frequently by juries.
So interesting point there. Let me ask you, do we know if prosecutors themselves are seeking the death penalty less often?
Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty less often. That's in part because they are aware of the reaction of the public. There was a highly publicized instance in the Carolinas earlier this year when a prosecutorial office announced that it was not going to be seeking death anymore because juries had returned life verdicts in the 6 previous cases.
Now, of the states that are issuing death penalties and carrying out the executions, is it the same states that we're seeing over the past decade or two?
The death penalty has been being used progressively less, and so fewer and fewer states are actively carrying it out. But what we've seen is that a small number of states are responsible for most of the executions in the United States. Texas, Georgia, Missouri, Alabama, Florida, and Virginia. And if you look at those 5, you've got almost all the executions in the U.S. in the last 5 years. And in fact, this year alone, Texas and Georgia by themselves were responsible for 80% of everybody who was executed. But one of the most important things to note is that at the same time that these states continue to carry out executions, the juries in those states are not imposing death sentences in anything close to the same numbers. So in Texas, for example, where you had 7 executions this year and you had 13 executions last year, juries imposed only 6 new death sentences in that 2-year period. That contrasts with the levels in the 1990s when in 1 year Texas had imposed 48 death sentences.
Interesting. Now, does this decline match or coincide with a change in public opinion about the use of the death penalty?
Public opinion is mixed. The public opinion polls indicate that support for the death penalty is at its lowest level in 40 years. The Gallup poll measured it at 60% of Americans when asked the abstract question, do you support or oppose the death penalty? 60% said they supported. The Pew Research Center poll indicated for the first time in the history of that poll that 49%, less than the majority of Americans, said they supported the death penalty. What's interesting, though, is when you then ask the policy question and say which is preferable as a punishment, the death penalty or life without possibility of parole plus restitution, more Americans now are saying they prefer the life option. And that's the case even in states like Florida, Louisiana, Kentucky, that are known as pro-death penalty states.
So what's driving this? I mean, if we're having some shift in public opinion and this also at the same time, this reduction in the use of the death penalty, I mean, what's really going on here?
I think what's going on is climate change in a metaphorical sense. We are in the midst of a major U.S. change in attitudes about the death penalty. And it's not attributable to any one factor or one circumstance. One thing that most people think did have a significant impact and is continuing to have an impact is the question of innocence. Since 1973, 156 individuals who were wrongly convicted and wrongly sent to death row have been exonerated. And somewhere along the line, the public understood that the death penalty carries an inherent risk that you may be sentencing to death somebody who is innocent. The fear about executing innocent people has been realized. There have been several instances in Texas where there are clear examples of people who are innocent who have been executed. And we have on one of our web pages a list of questionable cases where there are people who are executed despite significant concerns about whether they were innocent or guilty. And the list right now is at 14 and climbing. So that's been one of the major concerns.
Robert Dunham is executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. We have a link to the group's new report about the use of the death penalty in the United States. That link is at hereandnow.org. Robert Dunham, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.